You're listening to the Outclassed podcast with Mike Redding and Blake Seifert, exploring excellence in teaching, tech, and leadership.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Outclassed podcast. It's the last one for the year. Looking back, doing a bit of a wrap and just getting ready for Christmas and end of year. So looking forward to chatting through, celebrating a few things, looking forward to 2021. Blake, great to see you. How's things?
Very good, Mike. It's good just the two of us today and a bit of a reflection. I think it's been a hell of a year for us, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, for some of us, it's been worse than others. Obviously, with your guys, you've only been in school, about a quarter of the year or thereabouts, right?
Yeah, about a third, I think, in the end. But yeah, it was sort of touch and go, coming back and then going back into lockdowns and a lot of uncertainty. And I feel like now we've got a lot more certainty around what's going on. And we sort of know the drill, even if we had to go back into lockdown now. So yeah, it's been a tremendous learning experience, that's for sure. And I think a lot of people have had the opportunity to stretch themselves in ways they wouldn't have otherwise. And yeah, there's been a lot to show for it. So from that perspective, you know, there has been some positivity out of it, but certainly some grave and difficult challenges for a lot of people.
Yeah. I think one of the things we should do today is just spend a bit of time celebrating some of that, like some of the lessons we've learned, the way we have come through strong. Like without that hard time, sometimes it's, you know, grow. So there's a good opportunity to grow and celebrate that. Lots of changes. We've just been doing a bit of a planning session today for New Zealand and talking through some of the opportunities for 2021. And one of the great opportunities is that schools and teachers are more open to doing online PD. So, you know, professional development that's delivered online, which we think and have thought for a long time, does actually get you better outcomes. But people have been slow to adopt. So, yeah, there's been some good that has come out of it, I think. But before we dive into all of that, just want to give Stephen Hesketh a shout out from Hong Kong. I was on a call with him yesterday, and if you're listening to this podcast and you ever want to jump on a call, just reach out and say hi. He was saying, Blake, that he listens to our podcast and re-listens because there's so much in them sometimes that he just goes back through them. And he was hounding me for a new episode. I've been a bit slack getting those out, and that's totally on me. But so just giving Stephen a bit of a shout out and say thanks for listening. He's a great guy in Hong Kong. You should definitely look him up on Twitter as well.
I'll definitely do that. Hello, Stephen. Great. Well, yeah, I mean, if we were looking back, Mike, what was the big celebration for you? What were some things that we can celebrate out of 2020?
Yeah, I think that there's just been new ways of working and new ways of thinking for me in that professional development space. I think there's been good opportunity for that. It's forced us to rethink how we do things. It's forced us to evaluate what's good and what's not good and what could be improved. I think a lot of people went into survival mode, to be honest, and they were just like, okay, how do we pivot to just be able to get ourselves through this? But I think we saw it as a real opportunity to go, okay, let's just put everything on the table and see what's going to work and not. And it's been even really evident to me, like we had a team playing, just looking at the team in general last week, looking at 2021 and some of the things we want to do. And like, I've got to be honest, part of my mindset was it would be great to get back to running regional events and getting teachers together in the room and those sharing of ideas and so on. And one of my trainers picked me up on it and was like, you're not exactly walking the talk right now because, you know, we're talking about the benefit of online and, you know, what we should do. And your default is let's go back to running PD together. And so where's the balance in that? How can we do blended where there's some PD in person, but there's also PD and learning that's happening online and whether that's on demand or synchronous or asynchronous. So it was good for them to pull me up on that and just not default back to your default setting all the time, you know?
And I think that's definitely the risk in a sense, is that we just sort of go back to business as usual and throw away all the good learnings we've managed out of this process. But I don't think anything will be quite the same again, even if, you know, the vaccine comes and everyone sort of gets back to a new normal. I don't think it'll ever quite go back to exactly what we had before. Mm. So you mentioned earlier about, you know, the appetite for PD online, and you actually think that that's a superior way to deliver it. What makes you think that? That's interesting.
Yeah, I think what happens is you get to do it when... depends on how you're doing that. So if it's synchronous and we're online, like some of the conferences that we ran this year, where you come in, listen to a keynote, and then you bounce out and you do your electives, People definitely felt like they got more out of it for a couple of reasons. One was they got to choose the elective that they wanted, but they didn't feel bad if they bounced out of that elective and into another one. It's not like you literally pack your computer up and walk out of a room when the presenter's presenting. So it gives you a bit more freedom. But then there's a lot of back channel chat that's going on, right? So we have all of our chat enabled in the side and people are discussing things. And so there's an element of community building that you don't necessarily get when it's like stand and deliver from that point of view. And I think people just appreciated the fact that a three session to sit there whether you like it or not, in a sense, with that that ability to be able to run shorter PD, it's very targeted and very topic centric, so teachers could opt in, but then they get the recording afterwards and they can go back over it, so blending that synchronous and asynchronous. And I think from an asynchronous point of view, like if you look at all of our courses that are pre-recorded, we've seen a massive uptake in people using those courses. For several reasons. One, you can just dive into the little piece that you need, like that's just in, you know, just in time learning. But there's little tricks that we show people, how to watch our videos in double speed, for instance. And then you just sort of like zipping through the training and something grabs your attention and then you go back to normal speed and you watch that and you can rewatch it or you can practice it. So how to just win back your time. And so there's lots of reasons like that that teachers, I think, have appreciated.
Mm. Yeah, there's definitely some benefits there. I think the missing piece for me is that, to galvanize people in the room, you know, where if things get a bit hard, you know, there's no one to kind of lean on and ask questions to, you know, raising your hand is kind of hard online sometimes. Yeah. And I think that, yeah, whilst it's great that you can sort of get a buffet approach, I think it's sometimes a little less rigorous maybe than sitting in a room and saying, right, we're going to do, you know, the Google certified educator today, and we're all going to sit in the room and just get it done. Mm. It can be hard to foster that in a group, like if people, it's I think it's usually good with those early adopter types and already engaged teachers, but it's very hard. I think once you're on the fence about it already, and then, you know, you realize this is actually going to be a lot of work, and it's easy for you just to, like you say, jump out of there, zippity-doo out of there. So that's where there are still challenges, I think.
Yeah, we did work hard on that. So just having that place where no one can really hide, in a sense. So everyone's on a Teams call or a Zoom call or a Meet or whatever program we're running. And having some level of like that chat going at the same time. And so people are asking questions, but you're calling on people to answer. So making sure they stay engaged, doing things. I know Paul, one of our trainers, did like day-long trainings even with teachers, but used Jamboard really well, for instance, and had teachers throwing ideas on Jamboards and, you know, collaborating and creating and then calling on people so that they felt very inclusive. And so even at the end of that training, teachers who were like, I would never have thought that this would have been any good, they were kind of forced to be there, they didn't opt into it, walked away and just said, like, this is amazing in terms of our preferred model. We much more prefer this.
Mm. I actually did a white card induction, which is like, allows me to go onto construction sites. It's sort of a safety induction. And obviously they couldn't run them in person. I did it during the complete lockdown. And I was surprised at how good that was. Like, it was 8 hours, and I'm thinking 8 hours at the computer. Like, this, even for me, that's going to be pushing it. But they had described little protocols in there where they'd stop and ask everyone to, you know, put something in the chat or put your hand up if you've done this, or show, you know, demonstrate for me, you know, moving something or doing something, you know, in the environment.
Yeah.
And then they took us out into breakout rooms and gave us a little, you know, one-to-one exam like this, like asking a question directly and you answer, and then they sort of give you some feedback and marks. And and just because they were able to split up some different stuff throughout the session, it didn't feel too bad. And they let you break for lunch. And they gave you a timer when you come back, and you kind of check in, see how many minutes were left on the timer and stuff. So I think that, yeah, it sort of put you in a bit more control. But I can certainly see, like, I was talking to some staff at work about remote learning for the kids and how different that is. And I think for the teachers, it's great. You know, we've got professionals in place. When it's the kids, it's a little bit different. It can be a bit more, divisive. Like, I think the kids that were already motivated, that are already kind of like hungry for knowledge and want more information, they did really well. They loved it. they were able to say, well, great, no distractions. I don't have social pressures. I can just sit here and I can crush through twice, three times the amount of work easily. Wow. But then the kids that were already perhaps, you know, needing that social connection, like not even bad kids necessarily. Obviously, the school refusers were even more difficult. But I think where you've got a child where it's, and I'm seeing this across a lot of schools I'm talking to, where they're the ones that are sort of noisy in class and they're up on the board and they're doing working out and interacting, you know, all the time with the class and getting responses and they learn socially, mm-hmm. Those people sort of disappeared. You know, their results just went to nothing. So I think, yeah, it really was about that, almost that learning styles argument, isn't it? About the way in which you learn, it will affect, people differently depending on, what version of lockdown you're in. But it's certainly been the challenge this year is to figure out those kinks while they were happening. And then what we do now about it, you know, how do we follow up and bring everyone back up to standard and everything else. But, you know, we were extremely lucky. I mean, we were all set up with online tools and, you know, kids for the most part, you know, were able to just keep going without missing too much of a beat. So, yeah, we were very lucky this year. And, we're looking forward to a very exciting 2021. How about you, Mike? What are you up to? Are you going away over the break? I know New Zealand probably don't remember that there's a pandemic going on, but what's on for you?
We're still reminded every day that this could break out at any moment. They keep the fear levels nice and high. Don't worry about that. I don't want you being too loose. So, so we're going to go away for 3 weeks. I think it's really important to rest. So pretty much the whole team are taking 3 weeks off just because it's been a pretty horrendous year for us in terms of how busy we've been. Probably less so in terms of chopping and changing. I mean, at the end of the day, for us, we're training. And it's different online than, you know, being on a plane and traveling around and doing it. But at the end of the day, things didn't really stop for us. So, so we're going to take 3 weeks off, going to go see my wife's brother up in Auckland and then spend 3 weeks driving home back down to Queenstown. So doing a bit of a road trip. So we're not allowed to leave the country. So, yeah.
Just watch those midges.
Oh, man, those sandflies. Yeah, they'll know you. I was on the West Coast a couple of days ago. I'm still sore. Oh, last week, I'm still sore from it. So.
Yeah, I'll never forget that on the West Coast when I was over in New Zealand, driving through that West Coast highway or freeway or whatever it is and stopping off at a few places, got out of the car, I was like, we have to get back in now. Yeah. And inundated in 2 seconds. So. Yeah, cool. No, that's great. And look, I'm super busy next year, so we're not going to be doing too much resting. It'll just be prepping for 2021. We break up this Friday, but I'll be back on the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, all the way up to Christmas Eve. And then we'll be back sort of the first day after New Year's that we can. So, huge amounts going on next year. Very excited.
Is that to do with the new school build or new campus coming online? So what's keeping you busy?
Yeah, there's a number of sort of challenges we're trying to deal with and also opportunities we're trying to take advantage of. So obviously the new campus is a big one. And part of that build is that we have to extend our network to the other campus. And that requires some rejigging of what we're doing. We're taking the opportunity to kind of remap all the VLANs and the underlying kind of infrastructure. And that's obviously a massive job. Every server has to be reconfigured, every printer, every phone, every security camera, you name it. So, so that's sort of slowly happening. We're slowly rolling that out now. And then the stuff that can't happen while we're live this week will happen next week. And then we're lucky enough to be rolling out new wireless access points to the whole school. So 120 or so of those. And that means, you know, getting up and replacing each and every one of them for a new wireless access point, which is actually going to be Wi-Fi 6 compatible, so AX. Not that we need that now, but it's certainly going to help us out in the next few years in terms of not having to change again. So it's, you know, giving us some stability in that sense. And the more I think about Wi-Fi 6, like, you know, 5 gigabit speeds, that's just insane over Wi-Fi. I don't think we're going to need anything beyond that for 10 plus years. Quote me on that. I'll probably be terribly off, but I think like those sort of speeds are getting to the point where, you know, I don't see how we would, like, how would the internet take advantage of that in the next 10 years? I mean, maybe in 20 years, but, you know, that's, what is that, 500 megabytes a second. if videos are 500 megabytes a second, I'll be very surprised. But maybe with VR or something like that, I don't know. But We think we'll sort of future-proof ourselves there nicely, which is good. And then it's kind of looking at this big rise of what I call rise of the class tech. And, you know, a lot of schools have dabbled in this with makerspaces, and our new campus is meant to be a STEAM campus. So it's, you know, science, technology, engineering, arts, and maths. So that's sort of the focus, and a lot of design and fabrication focus. And so we're looking around schools, and if anyone's listening who is doing something interesting in this space, please let me know. But we've looked, you know, gone out and looked at recent schools that have built STEAM environments and STEAM focused campuses and stuff like that. And it's been a real sort of eye-opener in the challenges that you have when you're trying to roll these things out. And I think the challenge we have is one of the things I hate doing and I'm sort of unwilling to do is use this technology in a real tokenistic way. Mm. And we have elements of that at the moment that can support the curriculum. So you can say, okay, there's this little tiny task and we'll all jump on a, you know, a 3D printer or whatever, and we'll do this little task and it sort of half works and then everyone moves on before, you know, you really get anything sinking in. And so I think, okay, well, how do we embed this? You know, for something like engineering and fabrication, you know, we want to have the ability for kids to build things and see all the issues along the way with trying to build something. So thinking about that design thinking framework that I know, was it Ewan McIntosh, I think his name is, he's really big on. And so if you want to check his stuff out, it's really, really awesome stuff. But the design thinking framework, you know, in the generalized framework, you know, kind of has a bias towards you actually building things, actually doing things, so you can see the mistakes and learn from them and optimize and do all that. And I think a lot of the time, in especially in an academic school like ours, we can get caught up in sort of the bookwork, if you like. So that gives us an opportunity to really push hard into what that looks like. We're thinking, you know, okay, if we do 3D printing, well, how do we enable that? I mean, it's different. Every technology has its different constraints. 3D printing has the constraint of it takes 10 hours to print something. Yeah. That's a long time. You can't do that in a class. So having some congruity between classes, having a dedicated space where that can go off and print and you can keep running your class somewhere else. But then you compare that to like a laser cutter. Well, you could cut a whole class worth of stuff in a lesson easily. You know, there's quite contrasting properties of the technology, and trying to navigate that is really the challenge we're facing at the moment. Mm. And I think what we've realized is the sort of two factors that are going to hamstring us, or three. One is accessibility of the technology, and you know how good the experience is when you're using it. Obviously, staff want to be confident that it'll work.
Yeah.
The second one is the skill set of the staff. So, you know, are they going to be confident enough to use it? Will they have had training and have access to that kind of training? And sort of not just like general training about what 3D printers are, but like situationally, how would I use this with my class? Can I see an example of a best, you know, an exemplar that's done it or has a lesson plan for it, those kind of things. Because we are talking about something that's big and new and scary and kind of unknown for a lot of staff. So there's those kind of two factors. And then, of course, the final factor is the funding of it. You know, we can't just spend $1 million. Like, we have to do something that's meaningful within a budgetary constraint. And what we're finding is if you want to buy those really high-end, super reliable, super automated printers, well, okay, they might cost you $10,000 each. How many can you buy? And if it's a 10-hour print, you know, so those logistics we're trying to figure out. And we think, you know, ideally the best way is to buy more of a cheaper grade printer, maybe a smaller format. It can't do as big a print, but every student can get on and do it in a class. Every student can pick up their print in the morning and see what went wrong, what needed improvement. And over three or four periods, you could probably run a fabrication session and every kid could get something out of that that they can actually take forward into that design thinking process and start to optimize and really reflect on it in a powerful way. And I think a lot of what we're seeing with the use of it now, and not just us, but in other schools, is the outcome of what prints out of the printer is the thing that is graded. And we're trying to get away from that. We're trying to move to, well, the reflection of the process. In fact, if yours doesn't print right, if yours has issues, you may actually end up learning more. Mm. And you may have more to reflect on and more learning to I guess, explain and to talk about in your reflection. So it's really shifting away from that outcome being the thing you create. And I think that's a real kind of art mindset of, we create a sketch, you know, I'm going to grade you on what you give me. Yeah. Well, no, actually I'm going to grade you on the reflection and the learning that happened around what you did in terms of that science and engineering and design thinking process. So yeah, long diatribe, but that's sort of where we're at the moment.
Yeah, that's good. It's like making learning invisible. So exactly. How do you put the spotlight on those questions that have been asked, the discussions that were had, the changes that were made. Yeah, interesting thought process. I know we met with a guy in Hong Kong who fits out STEM labs in schools. That's his job all through China and Hong Kong. Cool. And I was asking him that same question. Is it better to go high end and have lesser technology, or is it better to go lower end and have more, like different variety? And he was definitely of the opinion, like spend less on 3D printing because he sees that sort of that technology changing, but spend a bit more on a laser cutter. And then he had a printer that you could do jewelry on, ceramics and things like that. So he was like laser printing, jewelry making, and a ceramic kind of a machine. Mm-hmm. And then a different type of printer after that. But he had some really interesting concepts. I didn't even think to tell you about him. Like he had all the furniture was codable. So the students would pull a like a module out of underneath a bench, for instance, on the side that had all the gear in it, and it would know if the they packed it back and pushed it in right. If it didn't, alarm would go off. He had things like a workspace table, but the kids could code it and it had all lights on it and so on. And at the end of the day, it would just lift up into the ceiling, so you had all this floor space to do robotics on, and then drop tables down out of the ceilings. But all of that, the students would have to code to get it all working. The furniture was codable and so on.
What planet was this from, sorry?
Yeah, this is the sort of stuff that's coming out of Hong Kong and China at the moment.
Wow. Yeah, that's insane.
Stephen Hesketh at the moment, he was saying in Hong Kong, the government's giving schools $1 million grants to do some AI, blockchain, big data kind of projects. The students to come up with an authentic project that comes up with that stuff, the government's funding that to $1 million in schools.
So. That's awesome. That's the other side of this as well. It's not just, you know, they're just examples, but we're looking at CNC mill and some other things. But then, you know, in the making part, there's other things that come with that, like sanding. You know, you make something, you probably want to sand it down to get the dimensions right, or finishing it with paint. So a painting booth, spray booth, those kind of things. Totally. And then you're talking about ventilation in the building. So, you know, it has all these sort of knock-on effects, and it's kind of chicken and the egg. And in some ways, we're having to wag the tails, having to wag the dog to kind of have this happen in a way that can be inspiring for teachers and can create opportunities. Because I think at the moment, you know, if we don't do that, if we kind of just go in there and say, well, you guys come up with what you think and we'll try and facilitate it, it's going to be too late. The ship will be sailing in a way. So so we have to kind of make some tough judgments about where we think things are going, what is the future and what isn't. One of those is definitely in the engineering space. But other, you know, conversely, we're also looking at experiences. So we're looking at, you know, we have this brand new building and there's dedicated spaces in there. Do we do a 3D cave where a whole class can go in and visit the Barrier Reef? Or is it, we want VR headsets on top of, you know, every lab computer, and kids can go in the lab and throw the VR on and go to the International Space Station? Or even, you know, one of my passions here with the flight simulator is, you know, being able to jump into an actual legitimate flight simulator and learn all the ropes. Every switch in the dashboard can be turned. You know, you can really tinker and play around, and the stakes are really low, right? You can just crash the plane and it doesn't matter. So that kind of stuff, giving kids exposure to different things through these digital technologies, I think is going to be, you know, one of those big opportunities for us as well. And then the third part is then in the coding side. And like, I think the best way to do this at the moment is through embedded technologies. So ESP is a big one, ESP boards. And there's these things called M5 stacks, which are like they're the size of, I don't know, like a matchbox basically. And you can they can get ones with touch screens, ones with LEDs on them, ones with just buttons on them. And they have all these plug-in modules. So you can plug in a temperature sensor, you can plug in a CO2 sensor, you can plug in a light or something like that. And the whole thing's built on the web, like through a web-based block builder. So you don't have, you know, it's not a high point of entry. Teachers don't need to know how to code yet to get that started. And I think in the middle years, like year 8 and year 9, that's really accessible. And it's also giving them principles of coding, which is really what we want. We want to be giving kids that principles of problem solving rather than teaching them necessarily. I mean, we should teach them some coding languages, but you know, we can't teach them all the coding languages. So giving them those principles in a kind of easy to maintain, easy to deliver way where staff aren't having to then stock take 10,000 little items afterwards. And, you know, you see a lot of those robotics labs where there's 1,000 drawers of pieces and it's like, how do you even manage that? Those kind of logistics. So it's balancing those two out, isn't it?
Yeah. So you mentioned two products there. What was the first one you mentioned?
The M5 stack, that one.
The other one.
ESP.
Yeah, what's that stand for?
So ESP is Esperanto, which is the language that they mostly use, I think. But the ESP have a series of super cheap prototyping boards. So there's ESP32 and ESP8266. And basically what it is it's a computer that runs like an ARM processor. So it doesn't run Windows or anything like that. But you can easily interface with it with Arduino code. You might have heard of that.
Yep.
Or there's other things called ESP Home, which lets you like flash it and connect it to things like Home Assistant that gives you a GUI. But it lets you understand how these things work. Like it seems really overwhelming to learn the entire stack of how the microprocessor works, how the GPIO pins interact, and then how the Arduino code sits on top, which is like a whole other ecosystem of things you need to learn. Being able to flash it with your little block builders, and there's a whole heap of online tools as well where you can connect over Bluetooth or you can connect over Wi-Fi. And once you're connected to the device, you can just flash it with your new, you know, just push your updates to it and see if it works. It's a really fast feedback loop for developing and doesn't require knowledge of every single layer in that stack, which of course, if you are interested in and if the school goes further with them, we can build upon that in the later senior years to actually give them, you know, real world prototyping experience.
Yeah, right. There's a whole lot of acronyms in there. GUI. Never heard of that before.
Expressive is what it's called. Expressive ESP32 and 8266. And to give you an idea, like I use these at home. I have one to sense my garage doors open or closed. Okay. And I use another one with a relay that actually is connected to my garage door opener and will close the door. And so one of the sort of real world applications for that is my ultrasonic sensor. When the door comes up, the beam gets blocked. And so I know that if this ultrasonic sensor says less than 200 mil, then I know that it's open. And if that happens at 8 p.m., I have Home Assistant tell me that it's open. It notifies my Android phone, the app on my phone, and the app has a little notification action where I can literally just see the notification. Like you can reply to an email on your phone, I can just press close door and it just closes the door. So super convenient. And that's just like one example of, smart home obviously is a place where these get used a lot. But, to buy all that kit, I think the whole thing with a relay and an ultrasonic sensor and the device itself and a USB cable, I think it all costs like $9, something like that.
Yeah. All right.
So incredibly cheap, incredibly.
There's a Christmas project for people listening. Hey, go grab yourself one of those and have a play.
Yeah, Home Assistant. If you want to talk to me about Home Assistant, Mike, I'll talk your ear off.
Okay. Is that all running through Google Assistant? You're saying it's running on an Android phone?
So it has an app for Android, which will leverage the notification system. So it'll, you know, it connects to Home Assistant as like a device, and then it will say, you know, you'll be able to create automations if your battery's low and things like that, or. Like it can tell because the app's installed when you plug your charger in, it tells Home Assistant you've plugged your charger in.
Right.
So it's sort of like your own private home automation system that runs locally. So you're not having to trust Google with all your data, but you're able to extend it in ways you can't do with Google Home or Apple Home or HomeKit and those kind of things. So it's very flexible. It's easy to get into, but it's also very extensible. You can use it. I know people are using it in like automation of factories and machines and things. They're using it in all sorts of different ways that wasn't first intended because it's so accessible and cheap to get up and running.
That's cool, because that's one of the questions we get asked all the time. We've talked a lot about privacy this year on the podcast. That so you're saying it doesn't, like, it's not running through to Google Assistant as such, like Google's not grabbing
it. You can connect it and you can decide what stuff you want to expose. So something like my garage door opener, I could put that into Google Home, you know, into the home environment, so I can connect my Google account to it. And there's a few ways you can do that, but basically once it's connected, I can then say, okay, if I run this scene or if I run this automation, I'm going to call Home Assistant to close my garage door or something like that. Or if my garage door opens, I want to call Google Home to notify me through my speaker in the lounge room or something like that.
Right.
So there are sort of a number of different ways you can do it, but you decide how much you're willing to interact with the cloud. And I think, you know, that's one of the core founding paradigms of Home Assistant, is that it is founded on your home should be private.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be in the hands of a big tech company. And
and
it's not hard to see why. Like, you've got companies like If This Then That that disappear. You've got pricing models like the Google Photos predatory pricing, that all of a sudden Google Photos starts costing you money. And you're like, well, if I hadn't known that when I signed up, I probably wouldn't have signed up. But now I'm in there, I can't, so much effort to move that I'm sort of locked in. It's a predatory pricing methods that I really don't like. So I think this gives you a bit of freedom against that and a way to kind of run it yourself. And you can just run it on a Raspberry Pi for, you know, $60. So
yeah,
you don't need a full home server or anything like that.
Yeah, wow. That's very cool. Something definitely worth having a look at. I know there's a few teachers thinking about their tech programs for next year, and that sounds like it could be a really authentic project for their students to dig their teeth into. And even if the students had to pay an extra $10 and they had something that they could take home with them.
Absolutely. And one of the things we're actually going to look at doing at school next year with our student tech team, which we're rebooting next year, is giving them a project for doing learner meters in the classroom. So Stephen Heppel, if you know, uh-huh. he's big into one of his passions is about the learning environment. So what's the CO2 level? What's the light level? What's the noise level in the classroom? So using exactly these sensors, he has a learner meter you can buy that connects to the cloud. It's like, I think it's $1,000 or something like that. You know, you could build that for $50, probably less per classroom. And so we're looking at, you know, running a little trial of getting the kids to build a few of these, connect them to Home Assistant, and, you know, have a little LED on the wall that goes red if something happens, or, you know, flashes orange and have a little key of what that means. Okay, CO2 is low, open the window. The noise levels have been too high for 5 minutes. So we're starting to damage our students' hearing. You know, people who blast the projector, you know, blast the sound on the movie, you know, you will be able to actually get a bit of feedback on that. If it's too hot in the room, optimal learning conditions, we can go orange. So that's something to think about as well. And I think it's probably something that's not spoken about too much. I mean, we sort of assume, you know, you turn the heating on, turn the aircon on, that'll be enough. But what's happening with the CO2? Are the light levels adequate for learning? You know, is audio too noisy? Is the humidity too high? There's a million different things that can affect your ability to focus and be comfortable in that environment and learn. And I think that's a good little project. You know, it'd be interesting to see if we can map some kind of academic improvements against it.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Hey, so you get the data and then try and filter out, okay, so out of all the data we gathered, which ones are your top three? Or if you look at that 80-20 principle, what's the 20% that's going to give us 80% improvement? Yeah. Focus on that.
Interesting write-up as well for other schools to look at what we found and see, you know, okay, well, what's the number one thing? Is it temperature? Is it noise? Is it, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think if your students write that, even better.
Absolutely. Students have to write. I don't have time, so.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's very cool. Yeah, well, it sounds like you got a lot on next year and a lot to be thinking.
Yeah, lots on next year, and we're rebooting our student tech team into more of a all-inclusive, you know, leadership opportunity for the kids. So not just, you know, come in and help out. And we had a few certificates they could do. Now we've really formalized that process. Next year, we're launching a whole new student tech team where there's going to be a team leader, you know, an office bearer kind of situation where there's like a secretary and someone who's in charge of the certification, someone who's in charge of growth of the student tech team and the membership. Someone who's in charge of, you know, enrollment into the team and exits and things like that to get them real world experience. So, you know, one of the things that's on our, and, you know, talking about vision, like this is all driven from the strategic plan, right? One of the things is job readiness skills. So how can we contribute to that? Well, we're one of the unique areas in the school that can directly contribute to that. We are able to provide you access and information and oversight and also opportunity to work in, you know, a really complex and multifaceted environment of IT. And you know, you can't do that in every facet of the school, but you can do it with IT and you can get them involved. You can give them some accountability, and we're actually going to build specialist roles for things where the data center, you know, role will have a specialist, the network role will have a specialist, the AV role has a few specialists, maybe the class tech role might have a 3D printing specialist and a laser cutting specialist. And their job is to help facilitate the teachers, help maybe even run some PD for those teachers. But also maintain the machines, look after them, be the expert on those machines, build the documentation, and also hand it over to the next person as they go into the senior years and they have to focus on their studying. The year 7, year 8 students that are coming through will be trained up, apply for those roles. And it's really like a real job. If you don't perform, if you don't show up, you get warnings and you get kicked out. So, you know, there's not that mollycoddling of, you know, we'll look after you or whatever. It's your chance to really try out work. Try out working in a governance model as well with office bearers and, you know, a group of students that are all kind of working to self-improve that system. Yeah. And so it's very ambitious, maybe too ambitious. I don't know. We'll find out next year. But
yeah.
But I think it's probably the biggest project we're undertaking at the moment in terms of its scope and its ability to impact what we're doing at the school, because if we can get that up and running, then we can afford to maintain and run a much larger classroom technology program in terms of more of these types of technologies, the 3D printers and stuff. Because at the moment, I have one tech that would have to manage, you know, a disparate 10 or 12 classes of devices and be an expert in all of them. It just isn't realistic. So give kids have got the spare time, they've got the willingness, they've got the enthusiasm. Let's get them to help us operate the school and help us get better outcomes for everyone. It just makes such sense to me.
Yeah, what I like from what I'm hearing for you there is that you've got a real why behind it. We've talked about that this year as well, like making sure you've got a strong why for what you're doing in terms of linking that to the vision. And I think so often schools will put a student tech group in because they've seen it at a conference or heard about it somewhere, and they just go, yeah, that's a good idea, and get some students together and throw it together and see what happens. But it's not like a long-term, it's not a well thought out project in a sense. So that sounds like you've kind of taken the best of all of that, put it together, but then really formalized it quite nicely and given them a pathway of development.
And they work through these little certificates. So they do an AV certificate, learn how to make a loom of cables, learn how to replace a projector, and then they can kind of apply for the specialist role. But all the while, they can also go up to like a second level of certificates if they complete all the first level ones. And they're just in-house ones we've created, and there's sort of a simple assessment by them. They're not super rigorous, and we're not pushing them to do it. But if they don't do it, and they stop doing them for a few terms, we'll just ask the question, why are you here? And if they don't keep doing them, they're out of the program. So it's sort of an up or out policy. And when they get to the very top of that level, we'll then support them. We'll say, well, okay, you've invested in us. You've, you know, given us some value. We want to give you value back, which is we'll pay for an industry certificate, a CCNA from Cisco or MCSE from Microsoft. And you can go actually get an industry certificate that you could potentially leave school with and get a job for straight out of school. You know, whether it's part-time around your uni or take a gap year or something like that. So it's really about giving them an option, giving our kids more options when they leave school to do better work, you know, to be more engaged in the work process and understand what it's like working in a team and what the dynamics are, and not kind of come in with an academic understanding solely, but also come in with a real world. I have worked in a team. I have rolled out projectors. I have worked with constraints and budgets and these kind of things. So I understand it. And I'm ready and willing to kind of participate in the workforce in a turnkey way. And I'm just hoping we can build like these super techs that can go out there and do some great work in technology.
Right. Wow, that's pretty cool. So yeah, I like the way you've thought that through and just really worked on it thought it out and made it quite authentic. So that's really good.
Yeah, if it goes any well, if it actually works, we'll probably end up open sourcing it on GitHub, the structure of the program. So
yeah, nice. Definitely be checking in on that next year.
So, yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, we're pretty stoked for next year as well. We're gonna, I don't know, what part of me just, you know, seeing everyone go into their shell a little bit around COVID and just, you know, what's the bare minimum we have to do to survive and so on. I've really wanted to push back on that notion and. It's almost double down or go big or go home sort of thing. So we've got some really good plans and how we're just going to serve more schools next year and get things going. And got a whole hiring process on at the moment. So we're just in the middle of all these interviews for different staff members. We're going to hire 5 new people next year. So massively ramping up the team.
Whereabouts are you hiring?
All over. So we're looking at marketing managers, some more assistants. We're hiring another trainer in Auckland to keep up with demand there. Got another business development manager coming on. He lives in Auckland as well. So, looking forward to next year in terms of all the new team that are coming on. And it represents about a 20% growth for us. I think we're sitting on about 18 people at the moment, so bringing on another 5. So.
You're a brave man. More staff, more problems. That's what I say. But
more opportunity, Blake. More opportunity.
That's right. No, it's great. And if there's one winner this year, it's definitely been technology. I mean, whether it's the price of their stocks or the usage we're seeing, and just the embracing of technology and the understanding that okay, this isn't a thing we use to enrich certain areas of the curriculum. It's like an underpinning basis for what we're doing. And my view is there's no such thing as a tech company. Every company is a tech company. So, you know, if you're a taxi company and then you think Uber's the tech company. No, Uber's a taxi company. You just haven't got your tech stack right. You don't realize you're a tech company until you're out of business because you haven't become one.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, we all have to start embracing technologies. We've got to get literacy in our kids. We've got to get tools in our kids' toolboxes like we had, or like I had moving into the workforce. You know, when I turned up to Coles Myer, I could use, you know, a simple thing like Excel spreadsheet formulas. I'm looking around at people saying, you don't know how to do a VLOOKUP? Like, this is going to change your life.
Yeah.
It's going to save you hours and hours of work. Like, you know, this simple thing. And so you think the analog of that being a kid going into a workforce, any job with Python experience, and he can automate something with Python, you know, pull data in and spit it out in the right format, or, you know, build worksheets for a construction business or whatever it is. Yeah. If you just have one of those little skills, you know, maybe it's fabrication with 3D printers and you can prototype things. Maybe it's, you know, understanding the nuances of laser cutting and realizing that what you think you want to do in your business isn't going to be possible because I've used a laser cutter and it doesn't work like that. So just giving that perspective, it doesn't matter what industry you go into, you're going to, it's a superpower, isn't it? It's like an unfair advantage. So, you know, we have to do better. And one of the pandemic, you know, the outcomes of the pandemic has been sort of pushing that in our faces, like, yeah, we really need this technology. We really need video conferencing when we have to work remotely and those kind of things. And now that it's a tool in our tool belt, you know, when we have a exchange program, we need to get on a video call. There's no barrier there. It's super easy. It just opens doors for us.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking to someone, they've got a business. They've been in a remote company for 7 years and they've just in COVID, they got made redundant. And they're like, oh, we're just going to help businesses go remote. And just sitting down and just talking strategy of how do you use these tools effectively in terms of collaboration in the cloud, in terms of meetings and working asynchronously across different time zones. And, you know, all these skills that we kind of take for granted because we just do it day in and day out, but most people are struggling with.
Yep.
I think to give students an opportunity to learn that way as well just puts them that much further ahead of the competition.
It does. And it's about getting that unfair advantage, isn't it? I mean, it's about taking kids that are, you know, get moderate marks, doing, you know, fairly well, sitting in the middle and making them exceptional. That's the challenge. Is it, you know, the kids that are exceptional are always going to be exceptional. That's fine. But how do you take the kid that had, you know, a pretty average upbringing from a pretty average family in an average socioeconomic area and give them a huge opportunity, a huge leg up? I think the only way to do that at the moment, it's not through getting 2% better literacy or 3% better numeracy. It's getting 50% better digital skills than what's in the market at the moment. Go work in agriculture and you have worlds more knowledge about drones and all these other things you can do to automate cattle management. Whether you know it's for automating cattle management or not, that's going to help you a lot more than a little bit more literacy and numeracy, I think. Not to say those things aren't important. Of course, they're critically important. I don't want to get too many flames, flames on that one, but literacy and numeracy are critically important. But I think if you want to talk about change makers and things that can scale, things that can you can take, you know, a small seed of an idea like some Python understanding or some understanding of technologies like drones or fabrication technologies, those things can scale tremendously, especially, you know, things like agriculture and those kind of industries. So, yeah, that's what I'm passionate about for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even if I'm looking at all the interviews that I'm doing at the moment, you know, I'm not looking at, I've never once asked, like, what did you get in English? Or I haven't even asked, what did you study at uni, really? I mean, I've asked that question, but I don't really care what
did you get a distinction or a high distinction? Yeah. Like that matters.
Like, I'm looking for those, and we talk about it, and industry's been talking about it. I want to know, talk to me about resilience, talk to me about adaptability, talk to me about understanding, you know, the market and how you've had to pivot to meet a client's needs, or, you know, talk to me about those sorts of skills that you've got, because we can
problem solving.
We can train you on skills on Google and Microsoft and Apple and Salesforce or whatever else we're going to train on. But, if you've got a bad attitude or you can't pivot or you can't handle pressure, then like I can't train that, you know, the only way I can train that is to put you under pressure and just about break you. And no one wants that. So,
no, well, that doesn't solve the problem. But, yeah, it's really about problem solving, isn't it? Can you take a set of variables and, you know, put them together in different ways to provide more value than the next guy? And if you think about middle management as well, like, you know, you hire someone to be a manager. I heard a good way of thinking about this is what makes a good manager is someone who can take input from capital, like take money in, and then deliver a higher standard or take less money in and deliver the same standard, right? Mm-hmm. So they're kind of the two measures of your management. Like, okay, can you take the same amount of money and get a better standard, or can you take less money and get the same standard? That's sort of how we have to think about it. You know, obviously that's simplified into a business process, but think about that in terms of your students. What skills can you give them to, work with the same constraints as everyone else? Everyone else can go out and buy a drone. Everyone else can go out and learn Python. But if they've learned it already and it's easy for them and they know what they like, if you don't know what you don't know, if you don't know Python can do that, you're not even going to look in that area. So I think, you know, that's where schools play a critical role in a holistic, wide-ranging education that looks at heaps of different things so that you can just pick that tool up again and say, I know how to use that. I'm going to go use it. Yeah.
I'll take the learning that you know in that particular area and apply that skill set or that knowledge and be adaptable and say, okay, well, I know that about this. What can I take from this to apply to that? Shortcut that learning
process. Critical.
Yeah.
Critical, which, you know, that skills stuff kind of ties in with my last exciting venture for 2021. Like, I didn't have enough going on. But, I think I might have spoken about this previously about a skills sort of assessment where we're asking everyone sort of, you know, to self-assess where they are with each skill. And then I'm asking my tech leadership team, which is a team of someone from every faculty in the school, to get a wide representation of, voices. A cross-check a self-assessment of how confident you are with particular technologies against a tech leadership team survey that tells me how relevant are these technologies. Mm-hmm. And that helps us prioritize where those technologies should sit. And in the process of doing this, I was talking to a researcher from Melbourne University about it. And he was saying, well, what you want to do is base that in some science, right? And I'm saying, well, okay, that sounds good, but I don't have all year to go and run a research sort of project and figure out what's what. But I've managed to find this amazing framework. I don't know if you've heard of it, Mike, the European Framework for Digital Competence of Educators. So it's called DigiComp.edu, if you look that up, DigiComp.edu. And there's heaps of research already based on this. In fact, a lot of countries within Europe, so within the EU, Spain, for instance, have built their own version of this on top of this research. And then, of course, by doing that, are strengthening the underlying research as well. And basically what it does, it identifies, I think, about six sections of proficiency levels. And it gives you wording and scientifically backed ways to define those levels. So from newcomer to explorer to integrator to expert to leader to then pioneer. That's kind of the spectrum, if you like, the continuum. But within there, they give you the language, right? And they say, well, if you want to move from newcomer to explorer, then that needs to show a level of curiosity and willingness. And if you move up the next one, it's got to be meaningful use of the technology and the ability to variate what you're doing with it. And then if you want to move to the next one, well, that's you actually able to be strategic with it. So that is solve big problems with it and diversify with it. So, you know, differentiate the learning, use it in three different scenarios in different ways. And then when you want to move from expert up again, that's the ability to reflect on your practice, share your practice, be confident enough to teach it to someone else. And then the final and the innovative, you know, sort of pioneer section, how you can critique and then recycle and renew your ideas and sort of, take what you were doing before and like improve on and optimize it and come up with ways of melding and meshing different technologies together. That puts you in that category. So what this does, it lets us have a scale for people to rate themselves on that's actually backed in some kind of science that says, okay, this is going to give you a fairly accurate representation of where they're at, rather than you kind of plucking names for different things on a scale out of the air. That doesn't necessarily, it means one thing to one person and another thing to another. Of course, this will still be subjective, but hopefully at least has a basis of science rather than you just making it up yourself. And I always encourage you, if you are making surveys, go and look at some literature, go and do some Googling for instruments or tools that have been built in the research first. And even if you don't match it exactly, at least you have a basis in science. And I think that's the important part of when we're sending out surveys to teachers. We don't want to be wasting their time. We want to be doing it in a meaningful and kind of considered way.
And then have you considered what the outcome, I'm sure you have, like what's the end game? So you've got these ratings and scales and pathways. Is there an expectation that teachers will go from one to another within a time frame, like A to B by when? Or like once you got the data, so what?
Yeah, so that's where it comes to overlaying that against the relevance. So rather than asking everyone two questions, which is, you know, across 50 different things, is going to be an enormous survey. We can't really do that. So we have to be realistic and pragmatic. And so we ask the teachers, every teacher, to rate themselves against a subset of tools, and we'll outline a tool and say Google Classroom. By this, we mean, because if you say Google Classroom, you say, oh, I use Classroom all the time. I send out stream notifications. I'm an expert.
Yeah.
But then if you say, well, no, we're talking about other things as well, assignments, gradebook, and they're like, what's that? Yeah. You know, so we have to define what Google Classroom is. So we would probably say, you know, Google Classroom, the use of gradebook, assignments, blah, blah, blah. Where do you sit? Are you an expert that's teaching other people, or are you someone that's just sort of starting to use it meaningfully and able to use it in a diverse set of ways? Okay, well, you're back here.
Right.
And so we ask that for each person. Then we overlay that with the tech leadership team. So someone from every faculty. So we're getting a nice balanced voice there about the needs of each faculty. On the relevance, so you might say, 3D printing, right? I'm just barely aware of it. You know, I don't know anything about it. I'm right at the start. But then if the tech leaders say, well, actually, we have no real use for that. There is no way for us to implement that in most of our subject areas. Then we're not going to prioritize it, okay? So, but if we get a cross-check that says Classroom is critical, like it's transformed the way I teach, it's really, really important, it's going to remain important, okay. And then we see that the use is, you know, barely meaningful, maybe somewhat strategic. Oh, we want to get that up to a point where everyone can reflect on their usage and improve it and share it with others. Then we really want to push for it. And the beauty of this is, like you gave me this idea, Mike, where we've already identified who the experts are then. We go look at the answer to that classroom question. We see the people who are right up in the pioneering phase, and we say to them, okay, put your money where your mouth is. Let's go. Yeah. You can run, you know, five of you can run a session each on Classroom. Here's what you'll need to cover. Here's what the outcome is, right? We want to move people up this chain, and here's where most people are. And we can group the really low performers, the medium performers, and the somewhat high performers to try and move everybody up in one go. So that's kind of the outcome. Yeah.
Yeah. We find that you need to put a level of expectation in that. So, you know, with that skills checklist we use in schools, you know, people need to become a basic to intermediate or intermediate to advanced in one tool, one every term.
That's right. Yeah. So you've got to keep
moving. But if you don't, they don't move. So
And we'll track that, and we'll say, right, this is an annual thing, so I'm going to ask it every year. Where are you at this year? Here's what, you know, maybe we say, here's what you did last year, and they can move things up. But you've got to be improving in some tool sets in some ways. But that's not to say you have to improve in everything. If 3D printing is not relevant, if you're a
100%.
You know, if you're a maths teacher that has to do handwritten exams and that's all you're focused on, fine. But there are other things you can improve in. Use of Google Calendar to coordinate with kids' catch-up sessions, or use of Classroom for, you know, gradebook to streamline your marking. So there's always something we can find, I think. And, you know, if we have that problem where people are so far up that high end, then I think that's a good problem to have.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think that's really important. So that's where we give that choice back to the teacher and say, you choose the tool that you need to improve in, because it's going to make your life better. We're not telling you that you need to use Classroom better. You're telling us that you need to use Classroom better, and we'll give you the tools and the processes to make that happen. Like, we'll resource that for you.
That's it. Yeah, you want to support their growth. And there is a model for this in schools. A lot of schools have PDPs or something similar, where you set goals in a particular set of domains, and then you track against those, and we'll help you achieve them. The difference with this is we're able to be very pointed and specific about, okay, you're stuck with this actual tool.
Yeah.
We have an expert on that. Next PD day, there's going to be a session on that. You get to choose your session. You know what you're low in.
Yeah.
You go to the sessions that you think are most relevant.
Yeah. No, that's really good. You'll see like a real shift, and that will then shift your culture, because that's when, if we're doing it, the definition of culture is that's what we do. Mm. So, when everyone's
I'm very on board, excited about it.
Yeah, you get the we, that's very awesome. You'll see some great gains.
Yeah, so big plans. We'll have to check in next year at the end of the year and see how many of them I managed to tick.
Yeah, I'll just do a
maybe
quick
one
check now. See how you go. That's why I really like that 12 week year concept, where you just pick something for a term and you just nail it. So prioritize you.
If only I could just pick one thing, though. That's part of my issue, I think.
Definitely. No, that's very good. Well, I think it's been a really interesting year. I think there's been a lot of change, but I think there's been a lot to celebrate. I think there's a lot to look forward to. I don't think the magic year fairy is going to wave her magic wand, and as soon as we tick over to 2021, everything's going to change. I think that's wishful thinking at best. That you know, you're still going to need to be strategic. You're going to need to be adaptable. You're going to In 2021, you're still going to need all those things that we've wrestled with, skills we've developed. We're definitely going to need to carry them into next year.
Yeah, I think they're just going to be even more important for giving kids job readiness skills, and more important for you to be more effective at your job. And also just to, you know, we're incredibly lucky in the countries that we're in. You know, looking around the world, I think there isn't better two countries than maybe New Zealand and Australia during this crisis. So, you know, we've certainly had our challenges, but you know, we've been incredibly lucky and very grateful for being where we are in the world. And, you know, it's just kind of that winning the lottery thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Definitely want to stand with those of you that are in different countries as well and back in lockdown. I know Hong Kong's back in lockdown probably of March, they're saying the kids might come back. So, yeah, crazy times, but whatever we can do to help, just let us know. If you just need a bit of support, encouragement, someone to cheer you on because you're doing amazing jobs, do that.
Yeah, and I'm just hoping that, you know, we just have nothing but improvement in 2021. So things can just get better and better and better.
Yeah. So to everyone who's listening, we just hope you have a really good break, that you do get some time to rest and refresh and recharge those batteries, come back ready for 2021, feeling strong. Whether you're in the Northern Hemisphere and you've got half a year to go, if you're in the Southern Hemisphere and you're looking forward to a brand new school year, new students and new classes and all of that that goes with it. But yeah, appreciate you having us in your earbuds again for another session, whether you're running or riding or driving or whatever you're doing. It's good to be here and be a bit of a support and a bit of an encouragement and hopefully a bit of inspiration for you along the way.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike.
No worries.
Thanks for listening. For more episodes and show notes, visit utb.fyi/outclassed.